I'm Will Harris, and today's program has been brought to you by White Oak Pastures.
All right, Thursday, 1 o'clock, and once again, you have tuned in to the Heritage Radio Network. You are listening to The Farm Report, and I'm your host, Erin Fairbanks. We're coming to you live from the back of Roberta's in beautiful Bushwick, Brooklyn, where things are sprucing up around here. Yeah, definitely come on down if you haven't been by in a while. The everything is in bloom. The roof of the radio station here is actually covered with the greenhouse, and so it's definitely worth a peek if you're in the area. But today on the show, we're going to take a little trip to Texas to chat with the guys of Revival Market, Ryan Parra and Morgan Weber. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks, Erin.
Awesome to have you guys on. So I'm excited. I don't know really much about Texas other than I'm not supposed to mess with y'all, but I think we're going to do a little bit of tussling here. You guys are located down in Houston. Why don't you tell us about Revival and what you do down there?
Sure. First of all, the Houston culinary scene is just really burgeoning in the past few years. It's a lot of support, a lot of local neighborhood support, a lot of great farms and ranchers have opened up their businesses in the past few years to really support the type of thing we're trying to do. And what that is really use products that are around us within 150 miles, whether it be beef, raising our own pork, or vegetables, and then using all those products that are around us in the ways that have, brought down European generations, whether it's curing an Italian-style prosciutto and making salami, whether it's just selling the fresh meat, whether it's making prepared foods using those local items, whether it's canning, preserving, and anything under the sun that we can think of, like making vinegars and syrups as well. So, we combine all those things in our shop. We're a freestanding market, and, we're open to the public. So we're open 7 days a week.
Nice. And you guys got started back in 2009, is that right?
We have a farm about 2 hours south of Houston in Yoakum, Texas, where we began raising pork in 2009, distributing that to restaurants in Houston and Austin, New Orleans. Did that for almost 2 years before we opened the shop, and the shop was kind of born out of the idea to be able to do all the stuff that we really wanted to do in-house. Morgan from the agricultural side, and then Ryan from the restaurant industry side. It was kind of a natural fit.
Nice. So let's talk a little bit about that. Ryan, you actually spent some time up here in New York City in your chefing training. Is that right?
I was lucky enough to work with Chef Jonathan Waxman and just had a great time. And he definitely opened my eyes to, the seasonal bounty of things and was a great mentor to me and had a great time. And I love Manhattan. Family there, grew up visiting at least 4 or 5 times a year and still do, and Manhattan definitely has a place in my heart, and all as does all of the city, so I feel a good tie, and I feel like I learned a lot of good culinary skills and techniques working there. I worked also at Le Cirque for a year and with Chef Patricia Yeo some time ago at AZ, where BLT Fish is now, but learning those tried and true techniques and being able to apply them here is, I feel like a good fit.
Yeah. So you moved back south and you kind of tucked into mastering butchery and charcuterie. And I know there has definitely been a revival. I know here on the East Coast, and I think pretty much across the country, of this interest in chefs and food professionals doing their own butchery and working with whole animals, and then the sausage and charcuterie making. One of the challenges often is figuring out who to learn some of those skills from. I mean, where did you pick up on that stuff? Was it trial and error?
Yeah,
or
to be honest, I totally understand the interest, and I'm in that exact generation that a lot around the country that the chefs are wanting to do everything from start to finish, and so I totally get it, and I totally identify with what's happening around the country. It was a challenge to learn from different people. A lot of it is self-taught, reading as much as I can. But we were lucky enough, we Morgan and I brought down a master butcher from Austria, Christoph Weisner, who runs the Mangalitsa Heritage Breed Society in Austria. We flew him down, and we did a fantastic seminar with Moos Fun Farm, which is just outside of New York up there. And we went for 3 days working with Moos Fun and with Christoph and did a full slaughter of an animal, eviscerating, then hanging, and then butchering 100%, and then lots of charcuterie work. And that was quite eye-opening, and that was a great start to what we call seam butchery, which is a more European style than the American butchery. And that I learned quite a bit there, and then lots of trial and error here in Houston.
Nice. Moos Fun is great. I think you can catch them here if you're in New York at the New Amsterdam Market on Sundays if you want to try some of that Mangalista pig. Now, Morgan, how about you? You don't have a culinary background. You came from a farming family but left and then came back to the farm, or what's your story?
That's pretty close. I've never cooked professionally in a kitchen, but always been obsessive on the ingredient side. My mom cooked 90% of the meals at our home throughout a week. At home, we didn't go out to eat a lot. Living in a small town like Yoakum, it's either Dairy Queen or Pizza Hut on any given night if you were to go out.
Got it.
her philosophy growing up was you can't make bad ingredients taste good. So she grew a lot of what we ate in the garden at home. And I guess I kind of just took that with me throughout college, and afterward worked in the real estate business for a little while, acquiring property for public improvement projects, like light rail expansions, a lot of boring stuff like that.
I just finished my urban policy degree, so I've spent the last 2 years talking about just that.
After 5 years of doing that, I couldn't take it anymore, so we had a lot of land in South Texas that was terribly underutilized. So my wife and I decided to start dabbling in livestock, and pigs made the most sense. It was definitely something that there wasn't a lot of in the Houston area at the time, and we wanted to start with the highest quality stuff we could. So we brought in the Mangalitsas and really focused on diet and what the end product would be as it relates to how the pigs are grown and what they're fed, and it kind of took off from there.
Nice. So I'm taking a look. You actually were speaker, I think, earlier this year at the Food Waste Texas Symposium. You were talking about heritage breed livestock. And so what was it about the Mangalitsa that made it the right choice for you? I mean, when you were looking at kind of the options for heritage breed pigs, did you consider some other ones, or why did that one jump out in particular?
We did. We started with Gloucester Old, a small herd of Gloucester Old Spots, and then started doing a lot of research with the Mangalitsas. They had just been imported about a year previously, and not many people had them at the time. So Michael Klampfer at Moos Fun Farm sent us a loin. We got a bunch of chef friends together, cooked it and tried it, all really loved it, so we brought it down. Also, the charcuterie scene was just starting at that point in Houston, so everybody seemed to be dabbling in it, and it was timely to bring in a breed that really did well with curing.
And what is it about that? I mean, is it the meat to fat ratio? Is it the size of different cuts? I mean, why is it such a good fit for charcuterie?
It's the type of fat. It's a really melts in your mouth, really incredible flavor and texture. And then also, and the ratio of meat to fat is very high on the fat side. And when you're doing charcuterie, that aids to the advantage. So, you know, a big, nice fat cap when you're doing, you know, curing the loin, say, is just fantastic. Somebody puts it on their mouth when it's done, and it truly melts. And, you know, it's hard to get that in some of the Texas breeds that I had used previously. And speaking to that moment when we brought in the Moos Fun Mangalitsa for the first time and we were there trying it, really was a night and day beside, you know, what we would call a high-quality Berkshire that we had bought here in town and did a taste test. It was really a magnificent animal and magnificent flavor. and we love to use it here. Right now, 100% of our charcuterie is done with the Mangalitsa, whereas we sell other heritage breeds in the fresh meat case. So we're, I think, a firm believer in it, and it's working out really, really well.
Nice.
You know, and it's not for everybody. Like, we don't sell it. Never really makes it in the fresh meat case because people are so, you know, we get a lot of pushback because of the amount of fat on it. For curing, it's been phenomenal.
Excellent. So now you had mentioned in your intro that you guys kind of set a self-imposed 150-mile barrier for your procurement. I mean, I, belying some geographical ignorance here, didn't realize that Houston was so close to the water. So can you talk a little bit about, you know, kind of what's lying within that 150 miles? I mean, are there things that are the Houston region is really known for? I mean, I always think beef when I think Texas, but is there other stuff going on there that really sticks out for you guys?
Well, it's kind of a self-imposed 150 miles, but within that 150 miles, there is so much available to us. Bycatch out of the Gulf is really getting popular in our area. You know, when snapper fishermen go out and drop a ton of lines, they don't necessarily always catch red snapper. But by the time those fish have fought on those lines for, you know, the hours before the fishermen come back to pick it up, you know, we want to utilize as much of that product as we can. We've got a lot of guys raising lamb in the area, pork in the area. We are a big beef state, so there's people that are really, really trying to do a great job with beef. We've got wonderful cheese makers. We've got bread bakers. We haven't really had to go out of that radius. We're not legalistic about that radius by
sure.
any means, but we haven't really had to go out of that radius. We've got antelope that's coming from Broken Arrow Ranch. We've got quail coming from Bandera. It's just fortunate that we have all this available to us. Now, when we can't get something like maple syrup or dried beans, or any, you know, Anson Mills has been a good resource for us, we will go out because we want to be able to provide our guests with a complete experience and not compromise in quality. So we look for like-minded companies throughout the country to kind of help achieve that.
Nice. Now, did you guys notice anything on your end with regards to the BP oil spill in the Gulf area?
Mostly, I would think mostly a media concern. It shut down some fishing for a while, but, you know, we didn't.
I would say the oyster beds were greatly affected, as I'm sure you've read about. So there was a somewhat of a dearth in the oyster production this year, but the fish, we haven't seen too much of a change. Unfortunately, a lot of New Yorkers are liking the Gulf fish right now, so the prices are skyrocketing. But, you know, we still have some of the fishermen down here that give us, you know, nice local fish on a daily level that comes straight from the docks, and that's really the stuff we're looking for and trying to provide. But, you know, the impact, of course, you know, it exists, and it's substantial, and I don't think we've yet to see the true impact of it, but yet we are still getting shrimp, fish, and the oyster season did just end. As I said, that one was kind of short and small this year.
Okay. Now, one of the things that we were chatting about kind of pre-show is distribution issues. I mean, when you're you guys are working in the supermarket environment, I mean, I know kind of across the board, you know, margins are tend to be razor thin, and there's always this pressure to, you know, drive prices down, and working with farmers, you want to be able to, you know, ensure that they're able to provide a quality product, and that's going to come at a higher cost, and then moving things around. I mean, how are you guys managing to stay competitive with, like, the Whole Foods and other area retailers while still kind of staying true to the values that you founded the shop on?
Sure. The most important thing to us is quality. So we feel like if we offer the quality, we're going to put it at a fair price. And we mark it up on a basic, you know, business management level. We're not, you know, we're not trying to go either way. We're not trying to push down prices nor inflate them. So we really just go true cost. And the once we have the quality of the ingredient established, we really just try to make that stand out. And I cook the dishes that, you know, we put out on prepared foods or preserved foods, you know, something that I would feel comfortable putting in the best restaurants in Houston. And I think that's something that the other supermarkets don't do right now. You know, to be able to serve a high-end restaurant quality dish in a market-driven atmosphere is something that at least right now is unique. And that's we tread on those waters. And then in the fresh foods, we offer the best ingredients that we can find.
And it's a constant battle for us to manage those costs. Like you said, when margins are thin, we're constantly trying to come up with creative ways to get as much out of the animals that we possibly can when they come in, which means not throwing, you know, really anything away. We utilize every possibly can, not because it's, you know, cliched or chic right now, but just because we have to do that to make ends meet.
Yeah, sure. And then, Morgan, how do you feel, like, because you're kind of on both ends of the spectrum, you know, you're on the producer end, and then you're also running the business and interacting with the public there. I mean, as a farmer, I mean, what do you see as the benefits of working with a market like yours versus kind of putting your product into a more traditional model?
We constantly, you know, when I would drop pork off at restaurants before the market opened, we wouldn't ever get to see what the end product looked like. I mean, we might be able to go and eat it, but here I'll drop, you know, we'll have pigs the day after we process them and immediately get to see the results of what we've been working on. So it's, for us, it's resulted in a, you know, one continuous experiment of constantly trying to tweak and get the product better. We've gone through about 8 different heritage breeds over the last 3 years, and it's been a direct result of that. You know, we'll raise something to market weight, and if we don't like something about it, then we won't do it that way again. We'll tweak the feed ration, we'll tweak the genetics that we're using for breeding stock, and it's just constantly evolving.
Nice. Well, it's so great to have that back and forth, yeah, of information. Guys, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. If people want to hear more about you, where do they go?
You can check out revivalmarket.com. We're also pretty active on Twitter. You can follow us at Revival Market and also on our Facebook page.
Awesome. Ryan, Morgan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, great to hear from you. You too. So we are going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will have Stephanie Fisher on the line to give us an update of her farm internship experience.
I start this off without any words. I got so high, I scratch it, I bled. I love myself better than you. I know it's wrong, so what should I do? The finest day that I ever had was when I learned to cry on command. I love myself better than you. I know it's
White Oak Pastures is a 146-year-old multi-generational family farm that works in cooperation with nature to produce artisan meat that is safe, healthy, nutritious, and good to eat. Without fail, we ensure that our production practices are economically practical, ecologically sustainable, and that the animals are always humanely treated. We never falter in our determination to conduct our business in an honorable manner. For more information, visit whiteoakpastures.com.
Blackmailed again, forgot to put on the zip code. I love myself better than you. I know it's wrong, so what should I do? I'm on a plane, I can't complain.
All right, we are back. You've tuned into the Farm Report on the Heritage Radio Network, and we are on the line with Stephanie Fisher. Stephanie, welcome to the show.
Hey, Aaron.
It's great to have you. So, Stephanie, we worked together at Heritage Foods USA over the past year or so before you left to go pursue a internship with Consider Bardwell Farm. So maybe we'll start there. Can you tell us a little bit about how you got up to Consider Bardwell and what you did while you were there?
Yeah, sure. I've always wanted to go into farming, and my boyfriend Noah also always wanted to go into farming. And we ran into Margo and Alex at the Goat-tober event. Margo and Alex are the farmers at Consider Bardwell last October, and we sort of just introduced ourselves because obviously having worked with them through Heritage, we really liked what they were doing, and I always wanted to work with animals, so we sort of introduced ourselves. And then kind of surreptitiously, they sent us an email in December and said they were looking for some kidney interns, and we were like, well, that's, you know, this is kind of like we're at a transition in our lives, we're young, so like let's just do it. So we packed up our apartment in Brooklyn and drove our car up to Vermont and moved up there for 2 months, working closely under Margo and Alex with their kidding program, basically helping them with all the goats give birth. So they have about 90 does, so they had about 180 or so kids by the time that we left.
Wow. So, I mean, what was that like? Where did you guys stay? What time did you get up? Like, how was the transition? I mean, going from, you know, Bushwick to West Paulet, Vermont.
Yeah. I mean, it was absolutely a transition. I mean, we've always loved the country life. Like, we grew up in that, both of us grew up in the Hudson Valley. So we're, you know, obviously West Paulet's really rural. And the community is really great. So it was definitely a transition from, you know, Brooklyn, but I don't know, but Brooklyn kind of prepared us for that, too, because, like, there's a lot of awesome things going on in West Paulet in terms of, like, food and community and, like, sustainable thinking. So it wasn't too shocking, but we did live in the West Paulet Fish and Game Building. We lived upstairs. There was no heat or hot water and no shower, so we did a lot of our showering at Margo and Alex's. They very nicely let us use their shower.
for their benefit as well.
But it was also an adventure. It was only 2 months, you know. We had these little space heaters, and we spent a lot of time with Margo and Alex anyway, so we weren't home that much. But we'd get up around 6 or 6:30 and get to the farm around 7 o'clock. And you know, it was a kind of a change going from sitting, you know, in front of a computer 40 hours a week to working with your body 40 hours a week and, like, being on your feet all the time. And, you know, Noah and I are both in pretty good shape, so it wasn't that much of a struggle. But I definitely, like, I talk about this so much, but being small, like, I'm 5'3", and, like, you know, 110 pounds or whatever, there's definitely some things that, like, I kind of had to figure out how to do on my own, like, lifting a 5-gallon bucket, like, you know, full of whey. Like, it's not that hard for most people, but I've had to, like, figure out different ways to, like, pour it or to, like, carry it, you know, without hurting myself. And so that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, sounds like also probably a really cute time. I know the baby goats are so adorable. Did you get attached to anyone in particular, or?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely had our favorites. I mean, they're, you know, out of 180 kids, we got to know maybe like 6 or 7 really well, and they sort of just became caricatures and like part of our lives. Even off the farm, we kind of like, we like gave them names and like gave them these voices that they talked into us. And so that, yeah, there was a couple. There was one baby that was like a 4-pound little runt thing. It was number 24, and it wasn't developing the same way the other kids were developing, so it kind of had this, like, monkeyish face, and it was really, really ugly looking, but it just had this little place in our heart. And actually, Margo and Alex recently sent a picture of the little guy to us, and he's only gotten more ugly.
Well, I think we can be attracted to both beauty and, you know, individuality. Let's leave it at that. So you guys spent 2 months at Consider Bardwell, and then you had a plan to head out to the West Coast. So I think what you guys bought a car, drove across country, and your plan was to work for another goat farm on the west side of the country. So tell us what happened there.
Yeah. So we, when we first got the job at Consider Bardwell, we were like, well, you know, like, let's leave Brooklyn forever. Like, let's just go. Like, I've always wanted to go to the West Coast. So we went on the ATRA website, and we were kind of looking through their internship and apprenticeship listing, and we found this one farm on the West Coast in Washington, right near OMAC, and we were like, oh, this is great. You know, like, they're a smaller farm. They have a small herd, about 30 goats or so, and they also had cows and chickens, and they wanted to get pigs, and they do... they had, like, a little garden. They also do timber. So, and it was an older couple, and we were like, well, this is great. Like, we'll get sort of the intensive farming stuff down at Consider Bargill. They have a really large herd. They're specialized. And then we'll go and kind of see what a more diverse operation looks like. So really pumped. So we packed up everything, said goodbye to both our families, and drove across the country. And we had agreed to stay with this farm until October for 6 months. And we had a phone interview with them and everything, and it all sounded great. And we saw some pictures online. So we get there, and we were pretty spoiled at Consider Bargill on that. It's a farm that's gorgeous, you know, it has a lot of money behind it, so it's well-maintained. And also, Margo and Alex are really great farmers, so they really take care of their animals. And, I mean, that's not necessarily being spoiled. That's just a good standard to hold. So we are driving through eastern Washington, and we pull up to this farm, and there's tons of, like, old rusted machinery all over the place, and there's, you know, the animals all look kind of sick, and they're all, like, they have these, like weird, like, nylon twine collars, and the chickens are, like, kind of running around their own filth, and it was just, like, a real shock to us having come from, you know, a really well-maintained farm to something like this. And but we were like, well, you know, we kept telling ourselves, like, not everyone has all the money to maintain their farm, and, like, don't judge a farm by its cover. Like, let's be open-minded about this. And we lasted about a week, and, you know, until we, you know, we slowly realized, like, this farm wasn't maintained, not because of a lack of money or time. It was just a totally different style of farming that we were, didn't necessarily...
You ran into some bad farmers, it sounds like.
Basically, yeah. And I hate saying that because, like, every farm has their own sort of stick. And you know, I don't want to be judgmental about that, but we just didn't want to inherit any of those sort of farming practices. So we decided to leave.
So, you know, I think as in any profession, you know, there's people who do things in ways and, you know, that are different from what you might choose. But then there's also people who just don't do a good job. And so it's interesting from your intern's experience to go from kind of one extreme to the other. And then you find yourself, you know, across the country from your family and friends and without a job. And so what did you do?
We packed up all our things after only being there for 6 days, and we were still within, like, our week-long trial period. So, under our contract, so to say, we were still allowed to leave. So we just packed everything up Saturday morning, and, you know, we don't have that much stuff, so it only took us an hour to pack up the car. And, you know, we said goodbye, said thanks, you know, thanks for everything, and drove to a cafe in town. And, you know, both of us the whole time were, like, in shock, like, you know, adrenaline's running, like, we've never done anything like this before, like, yeah, we're totally near nothing, like, eastern Washington's basically a desert, like, and it's mostly Indian reservation, so, you know, it's a very far cry from the East Coast, and it's also, like, really, really right-wing, so we're in just, like, a place that we are totally, like, out of our comfort zone, and we go to a cafe, and we're like, okay, game plan, we're going to go to the Astro website. We're going to go to, like, Woof, we're going to go to Good Food Jobs, and we're just going to, like, write down a list of any farm that we, you know, that we think could work, and write down the phone number, and then just give them a call. And so we made a list of about 20 or so farms, called every single one, and most of them had their intern positions filled, but a lot of them were really helpful. They're like, okay, well, you know, if you're interested in this, check out this farm, here's a good number to call. So we just, you know, that night we camped in the Wenatchee Forest outside of a little town called Leavenworth. And, you know, our heads are kind of, like, spinning with, you know, well, do we want a farm? Like, you know, we were so kind of shocked after having a bad farming experience, after coming from such an awesome farming experience, that we started to think, like, well, is it farming that we don't like, or was it just that farm, or, like, what is it? And like, what are we doing? Like, we both have, like, college degrees, and, like, we both had well-paying jobs, and all of a sudden, like, we have no income and no home, and we're, like, camping and living out of our car, and, but we just had to, like...
Adventure!
Also, we're really fortunate. Like, we have family that can support us, so we weren't really in that bad of a spot, but it was definitely sort of an existential moment for us, but we were really insistent on making it work, so we kept calling around.
Yeah, so what happened?
Sorry?
What happened?
So for five days, we basically drove all across Washington State. We crossed the Cascade 3 times. We visited about 4 different farms. And the whole time we're visiting these farms, and because I remember when I was looking for places to go after Consider Bar, me some really good advice. You were like, you know, try and talk to past interns on the farm, and if you can, visit the farm. And obviously, we couldn't visit a farm in Washington when we were on the East Coast, but that advice you've given me was like, I was like, no, we have to go to every single farm. Like, if we're going to work there, we have to visit it. You know, I don't want to get into another situation where, you know, the website says one thing, they sound like nice people, but it's a totally different thing to be working there and to be under the farmers. So we visited 4 farms. And when we were visiting them, we were kind of making a list of the things that we wanted to learn and the types of farms that we wanted to learn from. And for goats, at least, I was like, well, I want to make sure that they're a part of the American Dairy Goat Association, that they do DHIA testing, which is Dairy Herd Improvement Association, because that, to me, is a sign of a farmer who really cares about their animals. If they're willing to register them, if they're willing to test the milk, then they obviously are taking good care of them. So that was my kind of standard. And Noah was a little more loose. He's like, I just want to make sure I work with vegetables and, you know, do some sort of organic production. So that's what we were looking for, and he visited all the farms. And we visited two of the farms that we visited just turned out to be total busts. Like, again, it was the same thing. Websites were great. They had one of these places had Oberhasli goats, which is what we were just working with, and we were super excited. We got there, and it was just, like, a total mess, and the goats were healthy, but the place was, like, it was one woman running the whole show, and she had, like, 8 or 9 interns living in this, like, trailer park city on her property, and they were all a bunch of, like, ex-Seattle, like, grunge kids who aren't interested in farming at all. They just wanted to, like, live for free and work, basically, and they were all, like, smoking cigarettes and, like, you know, shooting the shit around the table, and we're just like, okay, we want to be working with people who are also trying to, you know, be a farmer or, like, learn farming techniques. So we were like, yeah, that's not going to work. And then we drove all the way across the state to visit another farm. It's, like, this well-renowned French creamery in Dayton, Washington, kind of, like, the southeast corner. And it was beautiful. It was, like, kind of a little bit bougie, and they had alpine goats, and the goats were really healthy-looking. But then it was kind of the same thing as the other farm. The woman was just, like, totally insane, and she actually, when she met me, she was like, oh, so what are you interested in? I was like, well, I'd like to be a dairy farmer. And she was like, you? She's like, honey, dairy farming's hard work. That's what you got him for, right? And put in my boyfriend. And as soon as she said that, I was like, we're out of here.
Oh, man. So where did you guys end up?
We ended up on the western side of Washington at Leftfoot Farm. We're about 30 miles or so west of Mount Rainier. We're about an hour south of Seattle, but it's still pretty rural. And we are working with dwarf goats, believe it or not, something that we never thought that we would do. I think dwarf goats kind of had this strange reputation in the dairy farming community. But we're here nonetheless, and it's awesome. We have a really nice setup, and we're basically in charge of a quarter-acre garden. We're raising 62 meat chickens right now, and we do evening milking, and we live on the property, and it's a really great setup. So
awesome.
I think it was worth the 5 day.
The 5 day trek. Sure. So
yeah, definitely.
We are just about out of time, but maybe before we go, I mean, if you had to say, like, your top 3 recommendations for someone in your position who, you know, was kind of looking to get into farming, wanted a chance to do the internship experience, what would you say to them, kind of knowing what you know now?
Yeah. I would say the first thing is, like, make a list of this of your ideal farm. You know, like, right now, like, map it out. And, I mean, obviously that's going to change. Like, you know, our farm has changed in the past, you know, 3 months or whatever that we've been doing this. But make a list of, like, the things that you want in your farm. And then look for those things in farms that you go to. Second thing is, like you said, visit the farm. Just, like, if you can, do it. And talk to the farmers. Like, really get to know them. And then I guess the third thing is also, like, and this kind of contradicts the first thing, but I think it also adds, like, a nice contrast, is be open-minded. Like, we didn't think that we'd ever want to work with dwarf goats, but yet here we are, like, happy as can be working with dwarf goats. So, yeah, those are probably my top three.
Awesome. Advice. Stephanie, thanks so much for joining us, and I look forward to hearing more of your adventures. Send some pictures so we can put them out on the Facebook and the Twitter feed so people can see see what a dwarf goat looks like.
They're pretty hilarious looking, but yeah, for sure. Thanks so much, Erin.
Awesome. All right. Well, the Farm Report is going to be on vacation for the next 2 weeks. We'll be returning on June the 14th. We'll have Sandor Katz in studio to talk about fermentation, so make sure to tune in. And until then, enjoy the ride.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.